It's Weed Week, guys, and given the nature of this subject in particular, I mean, we try to be as balanced as possible at the best of times, but here it's important to explore all sides. We've heard a lot of positives, but here with us now is Dr. Stuart Rees. He's a family physician in Brisbane whose special interest is in the medical treatment of drug addiction, here to talk the poorer signs of CBD, cannabis oils and cannabis that we've been discussing this week. Dr. Stuart, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Dr. Stuart, I'm looking at a press release here, and the headline is Cannabis Cure-All Can Kill. And the first thing that comes to my mind is it a case of, like anything, it can be mistreated and can kill, but there are benefits? Or is it a case of, no, this is actually something that we need to get rid of entirely, in your opinion?
I think that cannabis has a lot of parallels with thalidomide. I think what's happening now is a close rerun of the 1957 international disaster with thalidomide. Thalidomide is a drug that is still used rarely in medicine. They use it for one form of cancer and a form of arthritis, but it's very tightly controlled because it's known to harm babies and damage the genetic pool of the community. And cannabis is the same. Its benefits are largely unproven. I'm sure you know that there's a couple of clinical trials in pediatric epilepsy, refractory pediatric epilepsy, but that's the only proven clinical indication that's been through rigorous randomized clinical trials. And the other 60 or 70 things that they talk about it's useful for are all based on anecdotes. So it's not medicine. Cannabis is basically becoming the snake oil of the 21st century. The benefits are virtually, with that single exception, they're virtually all unproven in formal scientific terms, and the risks are well known. So you're talking about a 21st century snake oil campaign, and that's our concern, that the benefits are being overinflated, and the risks, which have been known for 60 years, no one's being serious about. In a lot of places, it's actually entering the food chain, so that people's ability to choose where they're going to be exposed or not has actually been taken away. So we're very concerned about widespread damage to the genetic pool for multiple generations through widespread population-wide exposure to this stuff.
Dr. Rees, yourself and Dr. Gary Hulse from the University of WA have done this world-first study suggesting that cannabis can cause deficiencies and issues with babies, but also can lead to types of cancers. What is it that you have studied that no one else has seen before? Why is this a world-first that you've discovered these issues?
Well, it's sort of a case of, you know, they used to have that policy in the US, in the Army, don't ask, don't tell.
Sure.
See, as I say, for a long time, the genotoxicity of cannabis has been well known since the 60s. There were powerful studies then. So the question that we became interested in was, okay, these studies are out there in the lab, but do they have any impact in the population health? This cancer stuff, is it reflected in population health? And when we went to literature, we found that no one has done population-wide studies. The literature on cannabis and cancer is a little confused. The literature on cannabis and birth defects is also in a state of flux, a bit controversial. But what we wanted to do is look at whole population patterns of disease occurrence and drug exposure. And so we've done that in America, and we've published a lot of that work. And there's signals are very strongly positive for many birth defects and for many cancers. And now we're in the process of looking at the European data, which is also doing the same thing. So that's what I mean about don't ask, don't tell. It hasn't been talked about widely because it hasn't been carefully looked for. A lot of the widely quoted studies of cannabis and cancer are deeply flawed. They didn't include all the people with a lot of cannabis on board, which is obviously where the signal's going to be. It hasn't been written about because it hasn't been looked. So we're actually looking in a new way, using the best data sets in the US and Europe. And we're finding very strong signals for the commonest cancer in adults, the commonest cancer in children, and in fact, a lot of cancers in prostate and ovary and testis. The testis cannabis testicular cancer link is well established in literature. That's not controversial, really. But the point is, it's in the adults, it's in the germ cells, in the gonads, in the male and the female, and it's coming out in the kids. Because of course, not everyone gets cancer, but when it's in the food chain and the population is generally widely exposed, even if you don't get cancer from it or have birth defects because you're not having kids, you're not the right age, whatever, the damaging effect on the genome is very serious because that's going to cause aging of your whole organism. So if it's applied population-wide, you can make your population much genetically older, genetically and epigenetically older. So we're very concerned about widespread community exposure. We're very concerned about the fact that the risks of cannabis are not being talked about, and basically all its benefits are largely anecdotal, so they're not scientifically established.
Dr. Rees, I mean, this really does point to one of the difficulties, I guess, it is being a little person in the world that we live in at the moment, where all of us just want to live a better life and a healthier life, and we hope that medicine is science-based and unambiguous. And I, you know, the parallels here for me are with COVID-19 also, that when we have our scientific community debating each other from polar opposites, it's very difficult for we little people in the middle to know what the hell we're supposed to do.
That's right. That's why I'm very grateful for this opportunity to chat with you on your show. If you Google Little Green Farmer, it's not Little Green Farmer, it's Little Green Pharma,
sure,
a pharmaceutical company.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be lost on radio audiences who didn't know that. So it's important to make that distinction. And when you just Google a basic Google, it tells you right up that this is a money-making operation. Now, that's a huge worry, because that's what we did with tobacco, right? Tobacco rolled out, and the companies made squillions, and the government paid for the heart attacks and the lung cancer and the strokes and the blood pressure and the black toes and everything else. You see, with cannabis, what I'm saying is the benefits are virtually all unproven, and the risks are well-known and well-established. And if you look at the population patterns of disease, they closely follow in space and in time and in causal modeling the patterns of cannabis exposure. They don't follow tobacco or alcohol in large part. In fact, when you crunch the numbers, there are actually more cancers related to cannabis than there are with tobacco and alcohol. So it's a more powerful carcinogen. It's a more powerful cause of birth defects. And even if you don't get those two, which obviously generally are rare, it will trash your genes long term. And not just yours, but into the genome, into the eggs and the sperm for the next four generations, because it damages the epigenetic control of the genes. And so that's why Professor Holst and I are very concerned. And you see, when you talk about medicine and the science of the expert, this is not happening medically, except that it's called medicine. This whole cannabis system is going around the checks and balances which apply to every other medicine in the country. See, not since thalidomide in 1957 has a known genotoxin been deliberately marketed for profit. And that is exactly what is happening now. We have this drug, is virtually none of its so-called positive benefits have been scientifically proven. It's a known genotoxin that is now being done in high-powered epidemiological study after epidemiological study. And this is being rolled out globally for profit by a bunch of billionaires, and George Soros in America is the leader of them, as you probably know, and he personally likes to smoke cannabis. So he's enforcing his will not only on the law of the land to allow this thing to roll out, but it's entering the food chain. Like in Mississippi and Kentucky, I don't know whether you know, but Holes in the Heart has jumped up 20 times the background rate. It's gone off like a moonshot, because this stuff, you know, the tobacco crops were taken out, the big class settlement. This stuff is being rolled out. It's in the water. It's in the food chain. It's fed to cattle. They have hemp. The hemp's fed the cattle. You know, and the Holes in the Heart has taken off. We've shown that that's related to cannabis. In France and Germany and Europe, the babies are being born without arms and legs. They're all worried. And parts of France have had rapidly increased cannabis. It's obviously in the food chain. It's not happening in Switzerland, where it's banned in the food chain. So you've got a genotoxin which is generally going to damage not only the genome pool of the nation at present, but for the next four generations, being done deliberately for profit. This hasn't happened since 1957.
You mentioned cannabis. You mentioned the things like cannabis being in food and smoking cannabis and so on and so forth, the history and the broader population and the issues that you're seeing through your study. Is that different from cannabis oil? Because like some of the things, that, and admittedly, like I'm no medical expert. I'm just your sort of average Joe who's seeing this stuff floating around. And I hear quite often that there's a difference between cannabis in terms of, you know, smoking it versus cannabis oil and what it can be used for and its medicinal benefits. But are there differences, or is this all lumped in under the one umbrella?
The short answer is it's all the same stuff. That's a very good question. Thank you for that question. And there's a lot of discussion now about cannabidiol, for example, and it's said to be not psychoactive. Of course, it's completely untrue that it's not psychoactive, because people take cannabidiol for their anxiety, which is a psychological activity. It's true that it's not hallucinogenic, and it's true that cannabidiol is not psychotogenic, but it's obviously psychoactive. That's why it's advocated for its calmative effect. And in America right now, I'm told there's a big craze on about Delta-8 THC, because, of course, THC is Delta-9 THC. But the reality is, this was shown 20 years ago, all the cannabinoids, they have a complex chemical structure, looks a bit like cholesterol. It's got four sort of, we call it polycyclic carbon rings all joined up. It looks like a bit like a lattice or a mosaic, right? And the cannabinoids are a bit different. They've got different alcohol side chains, OH groups and COOH groups coming off them. But the point is, it's the nucleus of the cannabinoids. The chemical name for that is a levitol. A levitol itself is genotoxic. So you can talk to me about delta-9 THC, delta-8 THC, cannabidiol, cannabichromium, cannabigerol, cannabinol. They're all cannabinoids. They're all highly genotoxic. And in some, these things actually trash chromosomes at the 100 megabase level. Okay, the human genome is 3,000 megabases long, and these things we have shown, we've just recently published, it directly trashes 20% of the human chromosomes, directly. And that's a heritable change. It's linked with birth defects, mental retardation, and cancers, and inheritable cancers. It's a very serious thing.
Dr. Rees, you're very well studied also in opioid addiction. And when it comes to serious pain treatment, people are often looking at the two options of either cannabis or CBD oil and opioids. In your studies, is cannabis still the more evil of the two options?
that's a bit like the question you say to the guy, okay, you've been sentenced to death. Do you want to be beheaded or do you want to be put in hot burning oil?
Sure, I understand that. I suppose that's the problem, right? When you talk about big farmers and lots of money and stuff, I mean, the opioid addiction is rife throughout the world and has killed many people. And I suppose that's where people get to when it gets to desperation of trying to treat ailments.
We talked about clinical trials a moment ago. If you go to clinicaltrials.gov, which is the world-leading clinical trials site, there's 2,000 studies on there. That's actually really bad news for the medical cannabis industry, right? Because you've got 2,000 trials. A lot of them have failed or been terminated or fallen over. Most drugs, once there's a clinical trial and it falls over, then it's dead in the water and it's not resurrected, okay? But this drug's got 2,000 clinical trials going nowhere at the speed of light. I mean, that doesn't look good from a formal medical proof point of view, okay? My friends are pain physicians, and the patients I know who've used it, its place in pain management is talked up, right? It's not the answer to a maiden's prayer that it's being painted as, okay? It's quite a mild painkiller, and it's addictive, you see. People get used to it. So it may have a role in pain. That's as yet unproven, but it's likely to be a very small role. And it's talked up in the press, but in the clinical context, and I've got patients who use it and want to use it and stuff like that, its clinical role is very small, if at all. And remember, it's unproven. What I've found is that I work with a lot of drug-dependent patients, and what I've found in my clinical practice, patients are looking for an excuse. Come on, doc, they say to me things. Come on, doc, invent me a reason. I want to get the weed legally. You know, I've been smoking cannabis for 20 or 30 years. I got a bit of back pain, doc. Will that do? It's that sort of thing, you see. I think when the clinical trials for pain finished, it's going to be probably a bit like it is in epilepsy, fourth or fifth or sixth line, something like that. So it's not the answer to a maiden's prayer that we're being told. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, from what I'm taking from what you're saying is that the toxicity of it, the repercussions of taking this at a genetic and cellular level, if it keeps going the way it seems to be going, we will have another tobacco on our hands, right? That's what you're saying.
You totally have, and another class action, you know, with thalidomide, because that's where thalidomide went. I mean, thalidomide is actually used today, as I said, you know, doctors use it, but you can't just get a script for thalidomide from any doctor.
Sure.
And you can't just get your script filled at any pharmacy, and even if the patient's got a doctor and a chemist who's authorised to do it, and most are not, they have to do special course before they're even allowed to take thalidomide. Thalidomide is a known genotoxin with a tiny, tiny, tiny niche place in the medical practice, and it's carefully controlled. It's got its own special rules, and that's actually why we have the modern drug regulatory system, because this genotoxin went worldwide. It actually went to the US. It was never marketed in the US because the genotoxic and the birth defect and the cancer part of the file was blank, and it was blank because the company knew it was genotoxic. Right, here it's the same. Cannabis and cannabinoids are actually marketed for the same indications as thalidomide was, which is anxiety and nausea and antidepressant and to sleep and for pain. And that's why thalidomide is marketed. So this is a rerun. I mean, you think about it. 2,000 clinical trials are going nowhere at the speed of light with this stuff. And all we hear about is the alleged medical benefits and the upside. There is no upside. I mean, the results aren't done. But you don't need a crystal ball to see this upside is not going to go very far at all. This thing doesn't have legs. So even if it was proven by other clinical trials, like I said, pediatric refractory epilepsy, in our view, its place in the community, it should be regulated the same as thalidomide because it's not much different. Now, there is a potency issue between cannabis and thalidomide. One tablet of thalidomide produced the terrible birth defects we've had. With cannabis, it's a dosing, and this is the other major concern we have. These effects, the genotox, is much worse at the higher doses, right? So what happened in America, as you know, they're legalizing over there, the amount of people smoking daily and exposed at the really high end has gone up 220%, and it's that high-dose exposure. We think that as the community doubles its exposure, the genotoxic effects are going to go up 100 times. That's the sort of thing we're worried about. So we're seeing a tsunami coming, and all our studies are showing this exponential effect is coming out really strongly in a lot of our number crunch, and we are exceedingly worried.
Wow. Dr. Stuart Reese, we very much appreciate your time and your expertise on this subject this morning. Thank you very much for providing your view.
Thank you. Thank you. Pete, Matt and Kimber.